It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. The O.J. Simpson case is getting a lot of news again because of the FX series that debuted last night. That was called The Crime of the Century. Kind of late in the century to do that, and maybe it was, but there were other crimes that had that appellation appended to them earlier, including the Leopold and Loeb case. 70 years before O.J., this was labeled the crime of the century, and it is going to get some focus next week on Tuesday night when the American Experience airs a documentary called The Perfect Crime about Leopold and Loeb and their attorney Clarence Darrow and the prosecutor who went after them. And here's the woman who directed and produced The Perfect Crime, Kathleen O'Connell. Welcome to the show, Kathleen.
Thanks so much for having me.
What were the circumstances of the Leopold and Loeb case? Let's just lay down that base right up front.
It's 1924. It's the jazz age in Chicago. Girls are wearing shorter skirts and cutting their hair. And a young boy turns up dead outside on the outskirts of Chicago. The police have no idea who did it. And then almost inexplicably, the clues start to point to two young, extremely wealthy college students named Leopold and Loeb, who have alibis for the evening. But it turns out, in truth, they were trying to commit the perfect crime. And they actually made it so complicated to make it perfect that they got caught. And it became a national obsession to wonder why these two college kids who came from families who were millionaires, who had everything going for them. One of them was headed to Harvard Law School the next year. Why in the world they would undertake this as an entertainment, a folly? And in the 1920s, which was a decade, the jazz age, who knew what was going to happen yet? It really put everybody on edge. If kids were going to be killing kids, what could possibly come next?
And in this case, when you refer to them wanting to pull off the perfect crime, that's the only way they looked at it. They had a real psychopath view of this, which is, we're going to find a victim, we're going to kill him, and we're never going to get caught.
Well, their names are so similar, Leopold and Loeb, but they were different. So Loeb was obsessed with detective stories, and he was kind of the brains behind it all, and concocted this elaborate plan, even after they had murdered the boy, of getting ransom from the family, and the family of the murdered child was supposed to throw it off a train, and it was a certain train at a certain stop. So he was kind of the brains before it. Leopold turns out to be in love with Loeb and was willing to do anything for his boyfriend to just be in his presence. And that's kind of how the whole thing started to spiral out of control.
When I call this the crime of the century, as it was known at the time, of course, we were only a quarter of the way into the 20th century at the time this occurred. It got tremendous media attention, which today means something completely different because we have all of our radio and cable news and network news. You know, they would swarm there in addition. But in those days, it essentially meant print coverage, right?
It did. It was newspapers, and it was carried coast to coast. The trial was held in Chicago, but it was by no means a local event. The New York Times covered it. The West Coast papers covered it. And interestingly, about radio, there was a vote in Chicago. It was run by one of the newspapers, and they asked the people of Chicago whether or not they wanted this trial covered on the radio. And because of the salacious nature of the crime, a child being murdered, the relationship between the two murderers, the people of Chicago said, no way, we don't want this beamed into our living rooms and around our kitchens. It's too much. So it was not carried on radio at the time.
Wow. Today, even if it weren't being covered live on the radio, carried live, as the O.J. case was 20 years ago, there certainly would be reporters inside running out and telling other reporters and reporting on it, and there would be nonstop coverage of a story like this, right?
Absolutely, it would be. And the challenge of telling this story for television is that it's the year before, 1924, when the Leopold and Loeb trial took place, is the year before the famous monkey trial, the Scopes trial that Clarence Darrow takes on the next year. He was famous before Leopold and Loeb, but him defending these two undefendable murderers in court and winning, in a sense, in that, not to give away the ending, they don't get the death penalty, which seems like an open and shut case, but he somehow saves them from the gallows. becomes even more famous. So the next year when the Scopes trial happens, the newsreels are running and there's footage of him on the trial and speeches. But during Leopold and Loeb, all we have are the newspapers, no radio, no newsreels. So we really had to rely on the court photography and headlines to help tell the story.
I will tell you that in watching The Perfect Crime, I got an advanced screener of it. Everybody else will get a chance to see it on PBS next Tuesday night. In watching it, I kept hearing echoes in my own mind of the affluenza teen case, which has sprung up again recently. This kid in Texas, Ethan Couch, who was driving drunk one night, killed four people, and eventually when it went to court, his lawyers said, well, he's so rich and so protected that he didn't know better. He's just too affluent to know that what he did was wrong. And it had echoes for me of the Leopold and Loeb case, because, as you mentioned, these are two privileged kids who could afford the highest priced attorneys and legal defense they could get.
Absolutely. And the papers jumped on that and called it the $1 million defense. And there was a sentiment in Chicago that somehow the wealth of these families would allow them to buy their children off, in a sense. Clarence Darrow, in the end, did not get paid anywhere near $1 million. And one of our experts did kind of suggest this might have been the first time an affluenza defense was used. But interestingly, I think of it more in connection with the Tsarnaev trial and the Boston Marathon bombers, which was literally happening here in Boston, where we're based, at the same time we were producing this. Hmm. Again, a pair, two boys, it was the brothers in the Tsarnaev case. The question was, why did they do this? Why would two college kids undertake this horrible terrorist bombing? Which one was the ringleader? What was behind it? So that was very much kind of in our minds as we were producing this Leopold and Loeb film.
Well, as you point out, Leopold and Loeb were in it for the fun, the thrill, to see if they could get away with it. But even afterwards, in court, they showed no remorse, right?
They didn't. They smiled and giggled during the trial. They wore their best suits. Clarence Darrow, I believe, to kind of deflect some of the inferences about their romantic relationship, would bring girls into the courtroom. You know, each of them had girlfriends as well, to try to put them in a more normative space. And I think they thought that they were actually going to get away with. I mean, there was certainly a lot of other things going on under the surface. The defense that Clarence Darrow mounted, saying that there were extenuating circumstances, their childhoods, how they were raised, the world around us and the violence that World War One had, what's the word I'm looking for, that had exposed us to, had somehow trickled into the DNA and psyches of people that would allow them to do such a horrible thing.
You know, you mentioned the Clarence Darrow's involvement, but what I was fascinated by and didn't know until I saw your documentary was that at the beginning, they essentially said, no, we don't need lawyers. And again, there's that privilege coming into play, to the point where they actually helped the prosecutors and took them to the crime scenes, didn't they?
They did. Well, this is before Miranda. So they had taken them in for questioning and held them for, I believe, 2 or 3 days before they actually got the confessions. And the families knew that their sons were being held at the police station, but were so convinced of their innocence, they didn't send lawyers, they didn't send anybody down. They said, oh, the boys will just take their time there and clear this horrible misunderstanding up. When they did crack and confess, they locked down the prosecution's case, it seemed, by literally taking the prosecutor, Robert Crowe, the prosecuting attorney in Chicago, on a tour of all the sites where they bought the hydrochloric acid that they used to knock out the boy, where they bought the rope to tie him up, where they rented the car under an assumed name. It was just a crazy scheme straight out of Pulp Fiction that they tried to make into a real life story.
So how did their very rich parents allow that to happen without a lawyer being present?
They were so convinced of their child's innocence, their kid's innocence. They were upstanding. These were both Loeb and Leopold families, leaders in the community. One father was a vice president at Sears Roebuck, which had its national headquarters in Chicago. And they thought their families and their children were, of course, beyond reproach. So they saw it as cooperating with the authorities to let the police keep their kids under questioning for a couple days.
Amazing. In your mind, having looked at this case inside and out, if they weren't wealthy, would they be dead?
There was a concurrent case in Chicago, very similar, with a young boy who was not rich. And the papers kept pointing this out. If you're going to save these guys, you got to save this guy. I do think that their wealth and status and the national attention to the case probably contributed to the verdict, which in the end, they had admitted their guilt to this. Clarence Darrow was not going to try an insanity defense. He said they're guilty. So the question that was being debated in court was whether or not they face capital punishment, be hung, or sent to jail. So a win in this case was them being sent to jail rather than being sent to the gallows.
And what happened to the poor kid?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I actually do not know. I will have to do a little research and find that out.
Okay. Now, we got to go back to Clarence Darrow for a second. Again, this was a year before the Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee. What drew him to this case? Why did he take it in the first place?
Clarence Darrow was based in Chicago, so he was in the area, and he was a staunch opponent of capital punishment. He felt that the death penalty was an uncivilized punishment that the United States of America had no business meeting out, or any country for that matter, to guilty people. So he had an inkling that this case was going to be a case that would be in the headlines. And he saw this as an opportunity to take his passion to fight against the death penalty to a national debate, a national audience, and kind of have it out on the front pages of the newspaper from coast to coast.
And after he won and saved their lives, although they did go to prison, and that's a story that you tell the resolution of in the documentary, after that, was Darrow successful in pushing forward the end of the death penalty? Apparently not, because we still have it in many states today.
It's true. He testified before Congress in Washington against the death penalty, and for the rest of his career actively campaigned against it, but as we know, was fairly unsuccessful. I believe it wasn't until late in the 20th century that the state of Illinois did take the death penalty for minors off the books.
Go ahead, finish.
I think what Clarence Darrow's legacy, one of his legacies from this case, is that when he was in the court asking the judge to present mitigating evidence, to present this background reasoning why these kids could have done it, this was unheard of. The prosecutor basically blew a gasket saying, "You can't do that." And the judge allowed it, and it wasn't until later in the 20th century that the Supreme Court of the United States said, yes, in any capital murder case, you must present mitigating evidence. It is now a requirement to present the evidence that Clarence Darrow fought so hard to present in court.
Well, it's a fascinating case, and you did a terrific job looking at it. I bet you had trouble getting it all down into 1 hour because there are so many different parts of this case that you could have explored so much further. It's called A Perfect Crime, the story of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb and their victim, a kid by the name of Bobby Franks, in Chicago in 1924. It will air Tuesday night on American Experience on PBS stations here in St. Louis and all across the country. The producer and director, Kathleen O'Connell. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.